So I'm going to talk about really three different things, points, of what's really needed to make science function in a more open model. The first is credit, scientific credit. Can you emulate what happens in open source software efficiently? Second is tools. If you think of how open source software works, I think a lot of the impact is lowering the threshold for collaboration. CVS has been remarkably effective in terms of encouraging code to be distributed. And finally, money, because it's not the same as open source software. In the case of open source software, all you need is a computer and an internet connection. If you want to do research, you generally need more resources. You need expensive equipment, biology. And to do that sort of thing, you need a way of collecting the money. So I'll address that. So firstly, credit. So attribution is necessary as part of the scientific process. The problem is that this attribution has kind of got mixed up with patents. And I'm going to argue that this is an unnecessary form of attribution. So we have this problem of intellectual property, not just patents, but copyrights and trademarks. I saw this up in Berkeley a while ago, and I kind of like it because I think it captures some of the idea of how science, in fact, most creative processes are done. The idea that you own anything is fairly ridiculous because you can never really tell what your influences were, how you came about with the idea you're claiming to be your own. And so there is an argument in patents that they reveal information. Now, maybe that was possible in the past, that they provided this incentive. It's not a question of intellectual property rights. It's not a question of me owning something. It was just as a sort of an incentive structure to encourage me to say what I know. But today, there are many scientists. We all go to the same meetings, we read the same papers, and even if it's not true, we think that we might have the same ideas at the same time. And in science, to get the credit in terms of academic credit, it's the first person to reveal what they know that gets the credit. So, in fact, you can see fields where there was scarce information at one point, and now there's a lot of information. And the incentive to reveal has increased. Protein structures are one good example where 10 or 15 years ago, there were very few structures, and it was very difficult to get scientists to give away the structure. Nowadays, they're rushing, falling over each other to get the structure out because so many other people might be working on the same structure. So I think as science scales, it actually encourages people to be more open. And so at that point, certainly, you can't justify patents on revealing information. That it's not necessary. So people claim that this aspect of patents is a positive thing. I think it's actually become negated. It's not necessary anymore. Right, now thinking of the genome. So that's a sort of negative example. Positive example is an actual piece of work where data was shared and what the effects of that was. So we had this race back in 2000 to get the genome out. It was one of the fundamental principles was an international collaboration where the different groups agreed on a form of data release, unusual in the scientific community where the data was released immediately rather than after publication. We followed this up inside my institute and other institutes, not just releasing the data, but also releasing analysis of the data subsequently. And you can see the effect of that. If the genome had been privatized, maybe rich scientists would have been able to pay for access. But you wouldn't get this sort of access where we see 80 different countries in any given week accessing this data. So, you know, there really is research going on around the world. In an internet-enabled world, there are institutes everywhere, and they're all looking at this data. Now, what's this done in terms of policy? Well, it actually has had an effect because it's been reviewed. This philosophy because it was somewhat new, the idea of releasing data before publication. And it's led to a policy at NIH and Wellcome Trust saying that there are actually maybe two types of projects to fund. There's projects which are competitive, where you fund several different groups. Maybe they don't have to release the data immediately, they can release on publication. But there's another class of project now where the data is of such value to everybody doing research that it's worthwhile to release it immediately. And those sort of projects, you probably only fund them once. They probably should be managed. But you can, it's not a problem for the scientists involved to get credit. What we found was, even though we threw away our data immediately, occasionally you get people who publish without acknowledging you, but in general you get a lot more credit than you lose. So the feeling of the scientists who did it was very positive. The feeling of the funders was that it was also positive. So this example is now being used and being spread around as being an alternative way of supporting research. It's led to a number of consortia. These are some which, in fact, are now involving industry contributors as well. So even industry is accepting that there are classes of data where it's better for them to pay in a public consortium where all the data gets released immediately than to go and try and buy it proprietarily off a private data provider. And it's even led to this HapMap licensing system where in the first two cases, the genome sequence, this is all in the public domain, which means that there is a risk of people taking the data and trying to get patents off it. But in the case, at least temporarily, the HapMap consortium is using a GNU-like license to protect the data. It does make things slightly more complicated for the scientists because of you can't use copyright to protect biological data. You have to use some click-wrap license. But this has been... This is a government consortium in this case, but it's been felt that it was sufficiently important to do this. So even governments are now using derivatives of the GNU license. Open access, I think it's important that these sort of bits of evidence that things work get collected in the form of reports. In the case of open access journals, this is an idea which is gaining momentum. I think the fact that the Wellcome Trust is funding serious investigations into business models and can produce numbers saying that they think that it's actually going to save research councils 30% on their budgets to fund this sort of model. These are actually quite important things. These are the things that you need the evidence to suggest to governments that these are good ways to go. And it's now going mainstream. This is just a snapshot of yesterday in The Economist. Open source in general, beyond capitalists as a new model, and particularly in the area I'm interested in, medicines, that open source might be a model for developing drugs. Now, that's one thing. The question of measures, we can talk about scientists managing to avoid using patents to measure their output. But there's a problem now with institutes, because if you go and look at what's happening in America, one of the reasons that tech transfer offices are becoming so popular is it provides a measure for different institutes to compare each other. They can say, well, we got 20% more patents than this other institute. It's becoming a problem. If we want to remove the tech transfer offices, it looks now economically as if it really doesn't contribute that much to their bottom line. We probably need to define new measures for institutes to evaluate themselves. If they can't do it purely on publications, maybe they need to develop something in terms of what's their contribution to society, some measurable quantity that they can compare themselves with. And similarly for governments. Governments have this problem at the moment where they are trying to justify their spending on science, particularly biotech, in terms of economic activity. There's this idea that means that you should patent everything because it will contribute to the knowledge economy, your own economy, at the expense of other economies worldwide. Now, actually, there's some evidence that you don't need to do this protection. There are, in the US, the investment in the internet superhighway probably caused enormous amounts of the feeling is that it led to the boom in the US. So I think we can justify, we possibly need to collect evidence for this, that science by itself is an economic driver. You don't need to excessive commercialization and protection. Just by funding more science, it's actually good for your economy in itself. This is another requirement to switch people to the idea of doing things in the open rather than closed. Now, I'll just briefly mention tools because I haven't had that much time. Is there an equivalent for CVS for biological data? Well, I think there is one example, and that's DAS. So one of the problems is comparing information. The web model, you have links to other sites. The problem is you don't get integration of data. And if you're talking about different people's opinion about biological data, it's then hard to see. You've got to go and look at all these different sites. They're all going to have different interfaces. One of the practical things that has been done in biology, particularly in the genomic world, is something called distributed annotation, DAS. And the model here is you standardize the way you serve the data, and you make viewers that can aggregate this data and display it in a common structure. In particular, in the case of the genome is a linear molecule. If you've got different annotations of where things are in the genome, you can collect this information in one place. Now, people don't like to download viewers, but you can web-enable that system, and that's what we've done on the Ensemble site. But it's something generic which is spreading around the world. It's very powerful in the sense that you can actually end up building virtual sites, which are just an aggregate of different DAS sites once you've done the standardization. It's some model that can be applied to other data types. We've been using it for linear data, but you can imagine it. We are also using it for stable identifiers, something like a gene name that has been labeled. But you can also imagine it being used for other types of information in biology, relationships between proteins or objects in the system. So it's a very generic system. These are the sorts of things that I think are going to be required just to lower the barrier. The barrier in software has been lowered by very easy ways of checking out code, making a small contribution and checking it back. These are the sorts of things required to make it easy for people to see each other's data. Finally, money. Jamie's going to talk about this in more depth. But the point really is that research is expensive. It's probably something we can't just deal about this in the sort of open source software way. So if you think about the way money is collected and used in research, the current way for drug development is something like this. A certain amount of money is going the public domain route from central government funding to academic R&D, but the vast majority is coming via drug purchases. The problem is that this is an incredibly inefficient system. You have this dogma that you have to do commercial R&D on drugs, and that requires this big marketing engine, and that, of course, increases the price. People don't realize how much it increases the price. Of course, it generates these thickets of monopolies of patents because you have to have patents in this model, but there are other effects. Only 10% of drug sales goes towards R&D on new products. It's a very low number. And if you go and look at what drugs are actually being produced in this model, 75% of new drugs have no therapeutic benefit. That means you're actually only getting 2 or 3% net of your sales going on new drugs. This is the effect of the distortions of the model. And of course, something everyone is worried about, it excludes vast numbers of people because they simply can't afford the prices. So not only do you have an exclusion, but it's chronically inefficient in terms of how it works and what it generates. So the justification for this and the extensions of TRIPS is to avoid free riding. Can you think of a better model? Well, maybe you can. Maybe instead, if you evaluate what people are already spending via their patent contributions, you can actually measure that in terms of GDP. You could then think about just switching the whole thing around. And instead of saying you've got to pay for patents, you've got to have patents and therefore pay these inflated prices, what about paying an equivalent in terms of your GDP directly? Setting a threshold where if you pay more than a certain amount of GDP, then you get an exemption from TRIPS. So it's a very neat way of doing it because you've got TRIPS as the stick to beat the governments to make sure they pay, because governments don't like paying. But TRIPS already exists. So a little bit of a modification changes things round. And so then you can go from this model to this model, where you have two different markets. You have a sales-based generic market, and you can have a virtual market for actually developing the drugs, because you've got a way of collecting the money, and you don't need the patents anymore to collect this money. At that point, you can just reward people for developing drugs directly. This will be discussed more by Jamie, and there's another session in the afternoon going into these models more deeply. So that's the message. Separate the markets. And we think there are reasonable ways of doing this. This is published in February in the Public Library of Science, which, of course, is an open access journal, so you can all go and read about it. Finally, I'll just end with a couple of incendiary remarks. So if we have this, what we'd really like to do, since this is really only being used economically, perhaps it should be changed. Perhaps it should just be changed into knowledge resource legislation, just to remove this idea that it's somebody's property. And at that point, you should interact with WIPO, because there's a problem with WIPO in terms of their labeling. WIPO thinks of itself as an intellectual property organization, but the UN definition of WIPO is that it's to stimulate creative intellectual activity. That's why there was a letter sent to WIPO by a large group of lawyers and academics in the field saying that they should start looking at open models. But I think we should probably go further in terms of this, what this means. What it really means in drugs is that it's a warrant. When you get one of these patents, it's a warrant to monopolize drugs. Of course, this has a very good frequently used acronym that maybe we can exploit, because actually they really are weapons of mass destruction if they're patents that prevent people from getting access to affordable essential medicines. We've seen things in the news, countries renouncing weapons of mass destruction. Perhaps it's time that we sell this argument, that it's time for us to remove these weapons of mass destruction in terms of their application to medicines. Thanks very much.
Okay, are there any questions? Oh, there's one there.
So, hi. Rather early in your talk, you presented the system with the metadata, you have this DAS stuff. Is there any kind of quality assurance built in this system, besides that people just put their data on the web and add the metadata, and then other researchers are building their research on this? So,
Yes, that's right. So it's kind of interesting, actually. I hadn't really thought of linking this to the Creative Commons, but I guess that would actually be a logical thing to do. I think there's a problem in science, because I think it's a naivety, actually. Science has existed before in the public domain. Copyright's fairly easy. You just stick something at the top of a document to say it's copyright. You can put a GPL thing if it's software, or you can put a Creative Commons label if it's text. But biological data, you can't do that. We actually explored this legally. You have to use ClickWrap. And then it just makes websites messier. And so we did think about doing this for the human genome data, and it got rejected. You know, there's been a tradition to put things in the public domain, in the public databases. So at the moment, I think people fall into this. They either put it in the public domain or they patent it. And maybe this is what the Creative Commons is talking about, is moving into the scientific realm. And maybe DAS, in terms of metadata, because it's machine readable, should be linked to that.
Yeah, okay, the other part. I mean, researchers are just publishing their data. If you normally do this in a scientific context with journals or so on, there's some kind of review process going on to ensure the quality of the data that are available then. Is there anything like this built into what you think how it should be?
So the meta-evaluation of the data, if you link things up so you can always go back to the original source, then, of course, you can subsequently evaluate the results, you know, and work out which data was wrong. I think the way for, if you have a browser which has a huge number of different tracks, scientists have got the power to turn off the tracks they don't like. And I think that what you can have linked to that is websites which evaluate which tracks are useful and which are not. It's that sort of metadata evaluation. So building some sort of post-evaluation model so people can build reputations on whether their tracks are useful. But it's not, you know, the directory, this is not developed yet.
Okay.
I'd like to ask a question on exactly the same line. You mean that that raw data that emerge are made public without any quality checking in advance. That means you use it at your risk. Now, in scientific articles, the reason we have peer review is because we don't want to use things at our risk. We'd like to have some prior assurance that they meet certain quality standards. Is this not true for data as well?
Okay, so this came up in the Genome Project. There's a big argument about, you know, if you release early, then people will get confused, there'll be errors, etc. Now, in fact, there's always errors. There's still errors in the genome. The accuracy is only 1 in 10 to the 4 or 10 to the 5. The general experience for certainly the class of data genome sequence is that people would prefer to have it even with the errors. And as long as it's defined well enough what the errors are likely to be, then that's okay. Of course, you use it at your own risk. There's always a risk that people will misinterpret it, but this is true of science in general. I think the feeling is that the benefits of the data being available early, you know, it's linked to your reputation after all. If the linking is good enough, then you won't release data which is complete rubbish because it will tarnish your reputation.
It's interesting that this is an empirical question in a sense. We feel that full research reports need peer review in advance because time is scarce and we don't want to waste our time trying to build on results that are not that won't bear the weight. So we have peer review. What you're saying is that when it's not a full research report but raw data, then the rules are different, or at least the payoffs are different. And you may be right, but it would be interesting to know what is there in the process from a full research report, which presumably gives some theory and gives some explanation and gives a sort of a whole chunk, whatever an article is, to a piece of data where we lose the need, where in that continuum do we lose the need for prior quality assurance before we risk our time and our money on something that may not bear the weight?
Okay, so I didn't talk about independent evaluation of outputs. Which is a kind of a key aspect of how the Genome Project was successful. This kind of evolved by itself. We put all this data out. In fact, there's a consortium of different labs, and then there were funders. I put that word management in terms of managing these open release things. What I meant by that was the funders got involved. We've essentially had conference calls every week during the genome period, and the funders were on the call, which is unusual in science. And what happened was the funders started to do their own Q&A on the data because the data was open. And they started sending us spreadsheets before those calls. They first started just counting how much we'd done, but then they started doing more sophisticated analysis. And so I think one of the key advantages of having open data is that it makes it free for anyone to go and do post-analysis on it and look at the quality. You see databases which did just accept, originally, in fact, structures as an example. They just accepted structures. At some point, they realized that some of these structures were completely wrong, and they started developing methods to evaluate these things. So I think you can set it, it's again, two markets. Generation of the data, you can have, if the data's open, you can have independent evaluation. And that's quite a strong model. It removes quite a lot of the biases because, you know, peer review is biased as well. This it seems to work. It certainly seems to work in large data resource areas.
Okay, we'll take one additional question.
It's really a small comment and a question. To respond to Stefan, it seems to me that, again, we must dissociate peer review from quality control. It doesn't do the job very well anyway. On the other hand, what I think what you're suggesting or leading us to think is that databases probably ought to be published with some sort of, I would say almost standardized means to measure the error level probable inside that database, exactly like in the way that physicists will always produce a measurement with an error evaluation of that measurement to make it meaningful. The database may include perhaps an error of noise, so to speak, that would make the thing much more interesting. And that could evolve as time goes on, because if you have indeed this ongoing real peer review, which is the work on the database itself, the quality could improve gradually.
Yeah, I agree. I think that that's exactly where open publishing has a lot to offer, because as soon as it's out there, you can start cross-linking it, you can start to post-evaluation on who's doing good contributions and who isn't. So data and journal publications, they can move into the same evaluation. Suddenly, you know, databases, one of the things I run is a competition for protein structure prediction. That's a similar idea. You make loads of predictions, we know a lot of them are wrong, but then we have a totally independent organization to do the assessment and evaluate and develop the evaluation things, because evaluating this stuff is a research field all in itself.
Okay. I'd like to come back to these crucial questions of quality assessment and openness in the final discussion, maybe, and would now like to hand over to James Love.